So maybe I'll just introduce the question answer session just with a word or two about Birshus Moreinu V'Rabbeinu Shlita. One of the great challenges in one of these question answer sessions, someone asked Rav Schechter recently, what's so challenging or what has been the greatest challenge through Corona for him? And he said that he just loves people. He likes to talk to people. It's so hard not to be able to interact with people. And that's something that we see every day in yeshiva, that Talmidim, different kinds of Talmidim, different kinds of people, all feel comfortable going over to Rav Schechter. His godless in Torah is universally recognized. But anybody who actually speaks to Rebbe sees his sensitivity, his humanity, his humility, his humor, his ability to make everyone feel comfortable. But even more than that, there's a comment that Tosas Yom Tov has of what the term Rebbe Muvhak means. And Tosas Yom Tov says Muvhak comes from like bohak, like a flash of light. So muvhak means a Rebbe that allows his Talmidim to shine. That a Rebbe who teaches in such a way and inspires in such a way that the Talmidim can grow and can shine in their own way. You walk around our yeshiva and you see the Rebbeim in the yeshiva, all stars and all Talmidim of Rav Schechter. All were given, we're all so many. The moon that reflect the sun, the light of Rav Schechter's Torah. And you have a special opportunity this evening to be able to hear from Moreinu V'Rabbeinu Rav Schechter. The Gemara tells us Kol HaMelamed is Ben Beno Torah, is Ki'ilu Kibla Me'ar Sinai, that if a person teaches his grandson Torah, it's as if he was Mekabel the Torah from Ar Sinai. There's a mitzvah in the Torah to teach your son Torah, and that mitzvah extends to the grandparents also. Why is that Ki'ilu Kibla Me'ar Sinai? So the Marshal explains, because you skip a generation in the Shalshalas and Masorah, that normally there's a Yeridas Hadorah, so we're always getting it a little weaker than the generation before it. But if you get to skip a generation, you get to get straight from the source, so you're really defying that Yeridas Hadorah in a certain sense. You're able to get it straight from the earlier source. Kilu Kibla Misinai. And most of you, almost everyone probably on the Zoom, learns much of your Torah, if not most of your Torah, from Talmidim of Rav Schechter. And tonight is your opportunity to hear from where we all got it from, to hear from our great Rebbe, from Rav Schechter, to skip that generation, and for him to be able to teach B'nai Banav, his way of life, his Derech HaChaim, and his inspiration of Torah. So with that, I just want to thank Rebbe very much for joining us and for participating.
Thank you very much. That was all a big exaggeration. I'm so embarrassed when somebody like Rabbi Leibowitz says that he learned by me. All the things that he teaches, he didn't learn by me. He's on his own. That's all on his own. Maybe a little bit in the beginning, but then he started growing and learning after he left Mashiach. I was submitted a whole list of 13 questions. I don't think I'll have time to go through all 13, so I picked out 6 of the 13. Someone asked the question, some of the stories in Bereshit sound unbelievable. Are they all to be taken literally? And what about Agadotem? The Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim writes that some of the stories in Chumash are supposed to be understood as a chaloim. When Yaakov had the fight with the Malach, so the Rambam thinks that that was a chaloim, that didn't really happen. The Ramban is bothered with the kasha if it was a chalom, so how come he was limping? It says after the Malach broke his leg, he was limping. So Le'al Yerecha, why was he limping? So the Ritva has a whole sefer, a small sefer, to defend the Rambam and the Moreh Nevuchim, many of the kashas of the Ramban. So he says that it's psychosomatic. Sometimes a person has a bug in his head and he's sick because of what he's thinking, because Yankov had a chaloim, that the Malach broke his leg, so that's why he was limping. The Malach didn't really break his leg. The whole thing was a chaloim. I remember when I was a little boy, they used to ask a riddle of the children, the young children, that the archaeologists were digging next to the Nile River, and they found the remains, they found the bones of 7 cows. So they asked the little children, do you think these were the bones of the fat cows or the skinny cows? So all the young children who knew Chumash, they all said, it's the bones of the skinny cows, because the skinny cows swallowed up the fat cows. So it must be the bones of the skinny cows. So the correct answer is, it can't be. The whole thing was a chalom paro. It was a dream. There were no 7 cows. The whole thing was a chalom. It didn't really happen. So some of the things in the Chumash we know never happened. That's a chalom. Some of the things we know did happen. In the days of the Rashba, there were many Jewish philosophers who thought that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yankov were not real people. They were concepts. And the Chumash writes about concepts. There's some people who think that the story of the Mabul, some Orthodox people think the story of the Mabul never happened. It's a fairy tale, and the Chumash wrote in the fairy tale just to teach the lesson of Schar V'Onesh. One Tana is of the opinion that Sefer Iyov didn't exist. It's a novel that was written by Moshe Rabbeinu. But no one said that Noach was a novel, and Avraham and Yitzchak were novels. These were real people. We assume the Mabul really happened, and Avraham and Yitzchak were real people. And then you have other things in the Chumash that we're not sure. The Rambam thinks that this was a dream, and others think not so. Or let's say the Haftorah from Parshas Chayisara, that Elisha Hanavi brought the baby back to life. So the Gemara seems to understand the baby was dead. And when Eliyahu Hanavi went up in a fiery chariot to heaven, he asked Eliyahu Hanavi if he requested of him, can he have Pishnaim Beruchacha? Can he have double the Koyach HaNevuah of Eliyahu Hanavi? So the Hanavi says that there remains to be seen. You may be given twice as the Koyach HaNevuah. So the Gemara says, what was the double Koyach HaNevuah? Eliyahu Hanavi was only Mechaya one Mesa, and Elisha was Mechaya two Mesa. So the Gemara understands that the baby was really dead. That the Isha Shanam is the baby was really dead. Elisha brought him back from death. The Rambam and the Mar Devuchim says he fainted, and Elisha Hanavi gave him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and he brought him back to life, but he wasn't really dead. That seems to be against the Gemara. That's a problem. Maybe the Rambam thinks there are other Midrashim that don't agree with that Gemara. So again, in Chumash, there are some stories that we know for sure they never happened. The seven Sinai cows and the fat cows, that was all a Haloim. There's some things we know. We have a tradition that's what really happened, the Mabul. Our tradition is there was a real person, Noach, and the Mabul really happened. Avraham and Yitzchak were real people. And other things, we're not so sure. Eov, whether he was a real person or it's just a novel by Moshe Rabbeinu, is a question of tradition. The Tanaim had different traditions. What about Agadatha? So there's a famous essay by the Rambam son, where he writes that it's clear that many of the Agadatas are not to be taken literally. I think there's an essay by Rabbi Sol Salanter. Rabbi Sol Salanter lived in the 1800s, and they once had, there was years ago when one country would declare war against another country, so the king, there used to be kings, so the king of the country would sign, he would dip his pen into ink. It used to be a bottle of ink, now we have ballpoint pens, nobody even knows a bottle of ink. When I was a little boy, you had to fill up the pen with ink, or you would dip the pen in the ink. Now no one ever saw that. So the king would dip the pen into the ink and sign a declaration of war. So the king signed the declaration of war, and then the first day of the war, 10,000 soldiers were killed altogether. So they had headlines in the Goyesha newspaper, 10,000 drowned, 10,000 soldiers drowned in one drop of ink. How is that possible? 10,000 people can drown in one drop of ink. So it wasn't intended to be a poetic. If you read the essay, if you read the news item, you'll understand what I mean. It doesn't mean that they drowned in the one drop of ink. I mean because the king dipped his pen in the ink and he signed the declaration of war, so the first day of the war, 10,000 people lost their lives. So there's such a strange Gemara. The Gemara says there was a gigantic bird, Bar Yochni, and it was flying in the air, and it laid an egg, and then the egg fell down by the pull of gravity and it cracked open on the earth, and 60 villages drowned. How is that possible? How can 60 villages drown? So Rabbi Sol Salanter said it was probably at the time that the rabbi was giving this sermon in shul, he was alluding to something in current events, and everybody understood what the allusion was. Like when they read the headlines in the newspaper about 10,000 people drowned in one drop of ink, the day that they read it, everybody understood it. But if you have the newspaper 100 years later and just have the headlines, you don't have the article, you'll think that's ridiculous. How can 10,000 people drown in one drop of ink? So he says, the Agadatas and the Gemara, a lot of times we don't understand it, but when they were delivering the sermons, they didn't intend that it should be a secret. Everyone understood what they were referring to. They were making a comment on current events. So a lot of times, that's what Rabbi Avraham Ben Aram writes, We have a lot of agaritas, and they're not to be taken literally. And we assume when the sermon was being delivered, all the listeners understood what they were talking about. So a lot of times we have difficulty understanding the agarita. Rabbi Soloveitchik, for many years, used to give a shiur every Tuesday night. There used to be a shul on the corner of Broadway and 80th Street in Manhattan. It used to be called Beis HaKnesses Maria. Now the shul no longer exists. Now it's a big store, a Gap store. And now the whole entrance, it used to be a building with offices. And had different offices for different things. One of the offices was bought by the Balabatim. They made a shul out of it. Now that whole entrance doesn't exist. The whole thing is a Gap store. So Rabbi Soloveitchik spent over 10 years learning. He gave a shiur once a week, and then before Yontif, he gave a shiur on Yontif. So he didn't always get in the summertime. He didn't give a shiur. So it took around 12, 13 years to cover all the brachas. Then they had a big siyum, had a fleishig meal at the end of brachas. So I came. I was in high school and college all these years. By the time I finished, college, and then Rabbi Soloveitchik was by the end of brachas. I used to go every Tuesday night. So Rabbi Soloveitchik would spend a lot of time on the Gemara explaining everything, but he would spend more time explaining the Agadita. So one of the Rabbonim, Rabbi Shusheim, used to be a Rebbe in YU, Rabbi Shusheim once asked him, how come he spends so much more time on the Agadita than he does on the Halacha? So he explained to him as follows, if the Balabatim won't understand the Halacha, they'll assume it was a difficult Halacha, they didn't understand it. If they won't understand the Agadita, they'll laugh at the Gemara, they'll think that it's silly. So he doesn't want anybody to think it's silly. So he used to spend more time on the Agadah to try to figure out what is the Gemara driving at. He did a very good job. Then Rabbi Shusheim asked him, how did you figure out how to interpret the Agadah? He used to give good interpreter. How do you figure it out? So he said, Father taught us how to read in between the lines. His father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, used to read the newspaper, and always the Goyish newspaper, or the Yiddish newspaper, whatever, and used to analyze what motivated this politician to take that position, what motivated the other politician to take that position. I remember for many years, Rabbi Goldwicht, the Rosh Yeshiva from Kerem Yavne, always used to come every year to YU, and he used to visit, speak with the students, and then if it would be in the middle of the week, Rabbi Soloveitchik lived in Boston, he would only be in New York on Tuesday and Wednesday, so if it would be on the two, three days that he was in New York, Rabbi Goldwicht would always go visit, talk to him. So in the middle of the conversation, they would sometimes talk about Israeli politics. Rabbi Goldwicht would walk out of the apartment, Rabbi Soloveitchik's apartment, and say, how does he understand Israeli politics? He analyzed perfectly what motivated this politician to take his position. What motivated this politician to take his position? He says it was fascinating how Rabbi Soloveitchik had that ability to read in between the lines and to understand what motivated each one to take his position. So agaritas are very difficult. Stuck a lot of times, very difficult to know what the Gemara is alluding to.
Rabbi, could I ask a follow up question on the first part about Chumash? To what extent are we limited in terms of darshaning Chumash? A lot of times we try to figure out what the Torah has to teach us about how people face challenges and all sorts of Musar messages. But sometimes that borders on psychoanalyzing the Avos. You know, to what extent, where do we draw the line?
It's a big problem. It's a big problem. The Ramban, every so often, will say that Avram Avinu sinned over here. So they say that Chofetz Chaim was not happy about those comments. How does he have the right to say that? So some of the Rambans, years later, they found it says in the Zohar. The Ramban a lot of times quotes the Zohar, and a lot of times he writes things without quoting from the Zohar. But sometimes he writes on his own. And the Netziv also gives original interpretations a lot of times. So the Chofetz Chaim is not happy about that either. See, the Netziv darshan the psukim as if he's a Tana. I remember when I was in high school, the Rebbe told us that the Chofetz Chaim was not happy with a lot of the Netziv's interpretations. And he wasn't happy with a lot of several of the Ramban's comments also. I don't know. Every story that appears in Tanakh, I always have the impression as if 98% of the story is missing. The Chumash only gives you 2% of the story. Then you look in the Midrashim, so they fill in a little more information, so you're only missing 96% of the story. But you're still missing 96. There's so many details that are missing. So how do you know how to interpret the stories? It's very difficult. How can you know how to interpret any story in Tanakh? Chumash doesn't tell you all the details. I don't know. That is a big problem. Someone raised an important question. Does it really matter who the president is, or should we assume Lei Melech Miyad Hashem? Lei Melech Miyad Hashem Kol Hashayach Bat Pal Gemayim. Lei Melech Miyad Hashem Kol Hashayach Bat Yaten. That's a pasuk towards the end of Mishlei. And there's a long essay in the Ralbag in his commentary on that pasuk on Mishlei. That it cannot be that a person is a king over a country, a president over a country. He can make a decision that affects hundreds and thousands of people and millions of people. A Meshuggah like Hitler decides to kill all the Jews and they allow him to do that. So we assume that Pal Gemayim Le Melech Be'ar Hashem Kol Hashayach Bat Yatenu. If you want to divert, you have a big river. You want to divert the flow of the river, so that's a major job, and you have to have people who know how to do it. If you just have a trickle of water, then that's palgemayim. That's you just put your hand there, and the trickle of water will be diverted to another direction. So the pasuk describes Lein Melech Be'ar Hashem, the heart of the king, the heart of the ruler of a big country is Be'ar Hashem, like a trickle of water. Be'ar Hashem just puts his hand, and he, as the king, make a different decision. We assume all the decisions that the President of the United States will make are all guided by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We have a chayvas hishtadlus. We have in all of life, we have an obligation that we should act as if there were no Hashgacha Pratis, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not running the world, as if the people are running the world. So let's say a person wants to get married, so he shouldn't just sit in a base medrash and the girl is going to fly in from the air. He should daven. Okay, you have to daven, but you have to do something also. You have to call a girl and make a date and take her out and see if you're for each other. You shouldn't just rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have to act. We have to act as if there's no Hashgacha Pratis, but there really is Hashgacha Pratis. And sometimes if we're not going to do our Chayvas Hishtadlus, sometimes we will be held responsible for that. We will be punished for not doing the Hishtadlus. So you have to go vote for the candidate whom you feel is best under the present circumstances. But the truth of the matter is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in control of Lev Melech Be'ar Hashem, and the decisions of the President of the United States will certainly have an effect on many, many people all over the world and all the countries of the world, and we don't have to worry that much. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is still in control of the world. What is one meaningful memory from the Rav's Shir? What was the Rav's biggest contribution to the Torah world? After the Second World War, and so many Talmidei Chachamim were killed, so many yeshivas, and they destroyed so many swarm. There was such a churban haTorah. So Rav Soloveitchik was sort of obsessed. He had so many traditions, how to understand Gemara, how to pass Shilas and the tradition. Traditions, how to navigate your way in Gemara. He felt like an obsession to transmit everything to the next generation. And he did a tremendous job. He transmitted an awful lot. He heard so much from his father and from his both grandfathers and from other Gedolim in Europe. And Shir, he would not only say things from his father, and he learned by both grandfathers. He would say things from other Rabbanim as well. He had a lot of tradition. He succeeded pretty well in transmitting many of these traditions. His comments on the Gemara and his traditions in Psak were very elegant. Other people have a rough style. You're always machmar on everything, a wild makel on everything. It was always with a cheshbon. Everything was very elegant. He would show you the way it says it in the Shulchan Aruch. He would explain all the dinim in the Gemara. He would take a Gemara and say over the din in English. So we would wonder, that's what it said in the Gemara. Yeah, after that, why didn't we realize? That's what it said in the Gemara. He was a big Machadish also, but I think he was stronger in saying over all the traditions that he had, and it was sort of an obsession by him. In the yeshiva, I remember the first year I came to Rav Soloveitchik's class, so the other rabbis gave a shiur 5 days a week, Sunday through Thursday. Rav Soloveitchik only gave a shiur 2 days a week. So I remember they put up a sign in the base medrash, Rav Soloveitchik will come the third week in this man, and everyone should be learning Sanhedrin. The whole yeshiva is learning Sanhedrin, and we should all the students should prepare till Davov in Sanhedrin. So I was wondering to myself, why does this man have to be different from everybody else? All the other rabbis started on the first day, and he's only going to start. The yeshiva always used to start traditionally the day after Labor Day. Labor Day is always on a Monday. Yeshiva always began on a Tuesday. That's in Shulchan Aruch, it says. She always began on a Tuesday, Yom Shehuch Babo Kitov. So yeshiva always began the day after Labor Day, Tuesday. He says you should either begin on a Tuesday or begin on Rosh Chodesh. Other yeshivas start on Rosh Chodesh Elul. And we always started on a Tuesday. Now it's under new management, and it's not necessarily either. It's not necessarily on Tuesday, not necessarily Rosh Chodesh Elul. Whatever the administration decides. So I remember I was wondering, well, the other rabbis came on the first day and they started plugging away, and he puts up the sign where he's not going to come till the third week. When he came, and he gave the first two shurim on Tuesday and Wednesday, at that time he only gave shiur 2 days a week, I understood why. He spoke very quickly. He gave each shiur was 2 hours long. He spoke very quickly in Yiddish. That time the shurim were not in English. The shiur was in Yiddish. He switched to English when he realized that there was one student who didn't understand Yiddish. He never realized all the years, never realized there are a lot of students that don't understand Yiddish. He thought everybody knows Yiddish. The day that he realized there was one student that does know Yiddish, so he switched to English. So he spoke very quickly, and he covered everything, all the topics. He didn't read every single line. He covered all the major topics from Dav Beis till Davov in 2 days. And then the next week he came in. He was already ahead of everybody else. Everybody else was giving Shia. This was already the third week of Shia. Rav Soloveitchik covered everything in the first four blot in the two shur. So then he went right. He used to cover a lot. He used to cover, in my time, there was a Yerida Saderis. He covered about between 35 and 45 blot every year. In the earlier years, my uncle learned by Rav Soloveitchik, they learned Baba Basra. So in 1 year, they covered from Dav Beis to Dav Samach till the end of Cheskes Habatim. Cheskes Habatim and Baba Basra is not so easy. He covered the first 60 blot in 1 year. I remember in my year, when I came into the shiur, we learned Sanhedrin. So Sanhedrin, the halacha goes to Daf Tzadik, and then you have the last three blot about Aaron Idachas. Then you have Perek Chelik, is all Agadita. So in 2 years, Rav Soloveitchik covered the 90 blot with the last three blot in the Masechta. He covered the whole Masechta. In 2 years, the whole 90 blot. He used to go there, he used to cover a lot of ground. That's one of the things that Rav Shach used to complain about, that the Rosh Yeshiva are going so slow, and they're not covering any ground. So everything else that Rav Shach said, they listened to. To attack Lubavitch and everything else they listened to. And this, no one ever listens to Rav Shach. All the Gedolim in Europe, they all covered ground. All the yeshivas, they always covered ground. Anyway, my image of Rav Soloveitchik is, he would always explain the Gemara, but he wouldn't say Svaris. He would always explain the Gemara by quoting another Gemara. If you know the Gemara over there, he would always give a background. He would always give the whole background, and then you would understand the Gemara. Easy? After knowing the whole background. He would understand it. He would say, if there's a machlokes hatanayim or a machlokes amarayim on a certain point, there must be 99 points that they agree on. They only disagree on one point. So let's first figure out what are the 99 points that they agree on, and then we'll understand the one point that they disagree. So he would give always background, quote the pasuk in Chumash, and how the simple meaning is, how the Torah Shebaal Peh understands the pasuk, how Rab Meir understood it, how Rab Yudah understood it, how Abaye, how Rava, how Rashi, how Taisus. And after he would give the whole background, what's going on, then it would come out, you would understand on your own what the machlokes is over here, if you know the whole background. I remember the shiurim was so elegant. I used to always dress up. I used to wear a white shirt and a tie to attend the Rav Shia. And we had the feeling as if the angels came to listen to Rav Soloveitchik Shia. It was so elegant. It was so beautiful. There's a lot to talk about Rav Soloveitchik Shia. It'll take many hours. Okay. How should one decide on a profession? What are the top priorities? If one is not sure if he's cut out for chinuch or rabbana, should he try that before assuming another profession? At what point should one stop learning full-time to pursue a profession? Look, the Gemara in Chagiga comments on the pasuk in Navi that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sheds 3 tears every day. Two of the 3 tears are that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is crying over the misplaced persons, the people who belonged to learning who went into a secular field, the people who belonged in a secular field and they went into learning. It's a tragedy. Sometimes you have people went into the rabbinate, and sometimes people went into chinuch, and they didn't belong in the rabbinate. They didn't belong in chinuch. Not everybody belongs. Even if a person is a very good student in yeshiva, he learns very well. Not every good learner is cut out to be a rebbe in yeshiva, cut out to be a rabbi. You have to have, it's not enough that you know how to learn. We know doctors and lawyers and know how to learn better than the rebbes in yeshiva, but they didn't go into chinuch because they're not cut out for that. They don't have that personality. A person has to decide what field he's going to go into based on whatever he's cut out for. Everyone has to do, we have to do b'halachta b'drach, we have to go in the ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is original and creative and artistic and everything, and we have to do the same. If a person is cut out for composing music or playing music, so be it. Let him compose music or play music. He's cut out to be a writer or a painter or whatever, or a novelist. Tell them that everyone should do whatever he's cut out for. If a person knows how to learn well and is cut out for chinuch, so adarabba, we need more good people to go into chinuch. We need good people. I remember years ago, maybe 60 years ago, they hung up a letter in the Beis Medrash that was signed by many rabbonim, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Yaakov and Kamenetsky, Rabbi Mendel Zaks. Mendel Zaks was the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim. He gave the smicha in Radna. He used to be the bochen in YU. They had Rabbi David Lipschitz signed it. The letter was signed by all of the elder statesmen, by the older rabbonim in New York City, encouraging B'nai Yeshiva to teach Torah on an elementary level. Everyone can't be the head of a kollel. Some people have to teach on an elementary level. Some people have to teach on a high school level. Some people have to teach on a post-high school level. So there was a problem that real B'nai Torah didn't want to go into teaching on an elementary level. So the rabbonim signed this kol kori, encouraging people. That's important. We need good chinuch on all levels. And sometimes the one who's the best learner doesn't belong in the rabbinate. A lot of times a person is so strong in learning, he's not cut out for the rabbinate. The balabatim all know what in the world he's talking about. Sometimes the one who's weaker in learning will do better in the rabbinate. I remember there was one boy, when I got smicha, the year that I got smicha, they still used to have a goyrel. They used to have a lottery, and everybody was getting smicha that year, had to put his name in the lottery, and the lucky winner had to go to serve as a chaplain in the army, or the Air Force, whatever. So I was in the goyrel, and another fellow was in the same goyrel. The other fellow couldn't read Rashi script. How did he get smicha? The Shach and the Taz are in Rashi script. The Ramon Shulchan Aruch is in Rashi script. He couldn't read Hebrew without nekudas. So I felt insulted. I'm in the same girl with this guy. He can't read Hebrew. So I didn't see him for many years. Neither of us went to the chaplaincy. We were not the lucky winners. I didn't see him for many years. Then it turned out he took a rabbana somewhere in the south. He married a nice frum girl. He had frum children. He sent his daughter to BJJ, and his son was at Ben Torah. And he succeeded in convincing some of the Balabatim to send their children to yeshiva. He convinced some of the Balabatim to become Shomer Shabbos. He started a kosher butcher shop in his community, and he started a kosher bakery in his community. He didn't know how to do it, so he called up the people in the OU. I remember my father used to teach. My father's Zichron Levracha used to teach in the Smicha program, so he called my father also. How do you make a kosher bakery? What do you have to watch out for? And then after many years, I was thinking, maybe he accomplished more for Yiddishkeit than I did. I'm speaking to people who are already religious and they're into learning, so I give him a very good shiur. Okay, but they would have been learning anyway, even if I wouldn't give a shiur. This guy got Balabatim to become Shomer Shabbos. He made a kosher butcher shop and he made a kosher bakery, and he got some people to send their children to yeshiva. Maybe he accomplished more for Yiddishkeit than I did. By now he's probably retired. I haven't been in touch with him in years. So a lot of times a person is not so strong in the rabbinate, not so strong in learning, will be successful in the rabbinate. It depends which rabbinate and which community. We need rabbis on many different levels because we have balabatim on many different levels. And we need people going into chinuch on many different levels also. But they have to be cut out for chinuch. Just because a person is a snappy learner, he knows how to ask a good kash, he knows how to give a good teretz, doesn't necessarily mean that it's cut out to be a good rabbi in a yeshiva. So a person has to, when he's deciding which profession to go into, has to be something that is cut out for.
Rabbi, should people consider, how long should people stay in learning before they go into their professions? I mean, a lot of times right after you finish college, there's a lot of pressure to move on to the next step. And in our, you know, a lot of times the only people that are staying and learning are the people going into chinuch. But like Rabbi said, a lot of times the better learners maybe would benefit from learning full-time for a little bit.
A lot of the people who are going to become doctors and lawyers know how to learn very well are the rabbi. If they can take off a year or two before they pursue their profession, matov. Best is when you first get married, if you're learning in a yeshiva, learning in a kollel, that'll start off the marriage on the right leg. That'll be wonderful. If the first year or two of marriage, the person will be learning in a beis medrash and a kollel, that'll be great. Sometimes he's already married and he has children, and so he has to make a parnasa now. But if he doesn't need the money right now, if he can spend a year or two learning, especially a year or two into his marriage learning, that would be great. That would be wonderful. Somebody wanted to know that I took a lead role in Paskening Shilas in this corona pandemic. What was the most difficult Shilas that I had to deal with? I have to tell you that it wasn't my idea. Rabbi Leibowitz can testify to this. It was not my idea to write up the Shilas at the Yesmi. What happened was, every so often I speak for the Rabbinical Council of America for the RCA. So they had they asked me to speak about a list of Shilas. So I gave what I think is the correct Mahalach and the Shah. They asked me Shilas about Kriyas HaTorah, about different things. I gave my position. So one of the well-meaning members of the RCA, who never learned in my Shia, one of the well-meaning members of the RCA wrote up what I said, Bikitzer, and he put it online. So some of the younger rebbes in the yeshiva realized that it wasn't really accurate. It wasn't wrong, but it wasn't really accurate. So they insisted, I don't know how to use the internet. I almost didn't get on tonight because I found it difficult to find a link. I know how to get to a link, that's about, but I had to call someone up in order to figure out how to get to the link. So some of the younger rebbes in yeshiva said it's not right. They insisted I should write up my decision, so it'll be clear. It won't be vague, and the reason will be clear. So I wrote things up in Hebrew, and a whole group of younger rabbeim, one of them was Rabbi Leibowitz, would correct it. They would tell me they don't agree with this. They think I should add this, take this out. They would correct it, and then they would do the translating into English, and then they put it online. I don't know how to put it online. I don't know how to take it off the line. I don't even know what the website is. I don't even know how to get it. So I don't know if that's called a leading role in Paskening the Shilas. Which was the most difficult Shilas? To tell you the truth, none of them were difficult. All the things that I wrote, I didn't have to work on these. These were old Shilas. These are Dinim Hilchas. I was fortunate. I learned by Rab Soloveitchik, so he spent time. He learned Hilchas Kriyas HaTorah. He gave a lot of shurim in Hilchas Tefillah, what you can skip, when we recommend to skip and when not to skip. We have traditions on all these things. It's not that the Shilas came up, now we worked out the answer. These were issues that were discussed years ago, and I just wrote over things that we had decided years ago.
Were any of them emotionally difficult for Rebbe? There were so many Hilchos Avelos questions and Chevra Kadisha questions.
No, unfortunately. A lot of people died. There were a few days in a row that over 500 people would die every single day in New York City. Now you don't have that. Now it's much more under control. There were very sad Shilas, right? Very sad. A lot of times the children couldn't go to the funeral because it was dangerous. The close relatives couldn't go. You couldn't do a Tahara. Okay, but that's years ago. They also had epidemics, and that's what they said. If there's an epidemic, so you don't do a Tahara. These are all in print. Everything is old Shilas. Nothing new happened.
Would Rebbe suggest that when the boys learn halacha, not to skip a sifkatan in the Mishnah Berurah if it doesn't seem like it comes up so often, based on the...
I remember Rabbi Meir Schlesinger, who was the founding Rosh Yeshiva and Shivat Shalavim, told us many years ago that the Sukkis, the year after Mechemet Sheshet Hayamim, So the Chalamoid Sukkis, he invited all of the Hezda boys who were in the army the year before in Mechemet Yom Kippurim to come to Shalavim, and they should write down all the Shilas that they had. So the Hatshkaila is about blowing shofar in a cave, out of a cave, dinim in the Gemara, can you be mitzar people to a minyan, some people on one side of Suez Canal, some people on the other side of Suez Canal, all kinds of funny shilas. So they wrote everything down, and then they worked on the shilas. So he told us that they worked out all the shilas. He says 85% of all the shilas are black and white in the Mishnah Brura, except that we skim over that. We think that's never going to happen, so you skip that, you know. But really, all the shilas aren't discussed. All the shilas aren't discussed. Rav Soloveitchik always used to, when he gave a shiur, he used to give shiur ma'gemar, he used to give shiur ma'shulchan aruch. When he gave shiur ma'shulchan aruch, he would explain what the din is all about, what's the basis of the din, and when it applies, when it doesn't apply. So then you apply the din based on the understanding. You have to understand the din, not that you're developing a new idea now. That's how we always learn the din. And when you apply it, you have to apply it according to the understanding of the din.
Can I ask Rabbi one thing about the Corona Shailas? Just because the first Shaila that we asked Rabbi was before Rabbi was writing the Tshuvas or anything, we had a meeting with a number of Rabbanim, all in the same room. We didn't even understand the dangers at the time. All these Rabbanim were in the same room, and Rabbi was on the screen, and a few other Gedolei HaRabbanim also that we were asking questions to. And the other Gedolei HaRabbanim that we spoke with suggested that we leave the shuls open and, you know, just try our best. And Rebbe was the only one at the time that was saying that it's dangerous and we should close our shuls. Because of Rebbe's strength of, you know, that suggestion, that psak, the entire community shut down their shuls that Shabbos. And probably that one psak probably saved, I don't know, hundreds of lives. At least dozens of lives. How did Rabbi arrive at that conclusion after hearing the same thing that other Rabbanim heard? Very respectable Rabbanim. And Rabbi arrived...
It's so obvious. We had a few doctors. So the doctors were describing what's happening based on what the doctor said. That's a suffix sakana. I can't understand. I said, what are you talking about? That's a suffix sakana. So some of the Rabbanim said not. So within 12 hours... That was on a Thursday night. Within 12 hours, on Friday morning, some of the Rabbanim backed out. They realized it's the Hafek Sakana. I don't understand. Why didn't they realize it the night before? They said, I remember when Rabbi Elbala Soloveitchik passed away, so they wrote a lot about the Rabbi Elbala in the Israeli newspapers. I remember there was one newspaper where they wrote over different stories. So they wrote the following, that Rabbi Elbala Soloveitchik said he doesn't compare to his father at all. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had such a deep insight into political issues, he can tell you if you take a position, you go to the right, what will happen in another 60 years, and you go to the left, what will be the result? What will happen in another 60 years? He said, I don't have that ability at all. To analyze so well, to predict what's going to be in the future, but he paused for a moment, then he said, but I think I have a mila over my other contemporaries. At least I can see what's under my nose. Mamish, the doctors are describing what's happening, and one of the doctors is a rabbi, a Talmud Chacham also, who gives shiurim. He's describing, that's called the suffix sakana. What's the shaila? That is a suffix sakana. What then is a suffix sakana? So at least I could see what's under my nose. I don't understand why the others didn't realize it. I thought it's vaday a suffix sakana. Yeah, one of the things that that I told people was, I wrote this up also, when you have there were so many people in the hospital, the hospitals were overburdened and the nurses weren't able to take care of all of the people. And a lot of the people, they were just negligent. A lot of the people, they didn't even give them intravenous. They didn't give them anything. A lot of people, they never cleaned them. They just, the Chevra Gadish, who had to bury them, they said they were completely filthy. The hospital didn't take care of them at all. So I told a few people, and I wrote it up also, if you have a relative who's in the hospital, you have to call every single day, including Shabbos and Yom Tov. You have to call on the phone and ask, how is my husband doing? And how is my child doing? If you're not going to call, they're not going to take care of him. If you keep on calling every day, if the nurses know, I'm one of the patients, they said they wrote that on the chart, it's going to be Shabbos and Yom Tov, and they're Orthodox, and they're not going to call. If you know, no one's going to call, so you're going to be negligent. They're not going to take care of it because they were overburdened. So people thanked me afterwards. They told me that I saved their spouses' lives. I saved their children's lives because they called every day on Shabbos and Yom Tov. That's a suffix sakona. That was a suffix sakana. There's another question here, which is a very important one. Most of us recently started learning seriously. Can we really expect to become Talmid HaChachamim or learn Kol HaTorah Kula? Should that be our goal? Rabbi Akiva didn't start learning it till after the age of 40. And the whole Torah Shebaal Peh went through Rabbi Akiva. Kula, the whole Stam Sifra, Stam Sifrei, Stam Mishnah, everything went through Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yechim Ben Zakkai also, the Gemara says, the first 40 years of his life, he dealt in business and he retired from business at the age of 40. Then he learned for 40 years. Then at the age of 80, he was appointed chief rabbi. He was the biggest Talmid Chacham of the generation. So I guess he learned a little bit before, but the main learning he did after the age of 40. It is possible to learn Kol HaTorah Kula. The Baal HaTanya wrote his own Shulchan Aruch, you all know it. Mishneh Berurah quotes it every other page. Shulchan Aruch HaRab Baal HaTanya. So everything the Baal HaTanya wrote is along the lines like a Chayyodim, like a Chokhm Sod. It gives you the kids of the background of the din, and whenever there's machlekes, the Shach and the Taz, or the Taz and the Magen Avraham, so he'll tell you the Hachru Psak. Except for Hilchas Talmud Torah. Hilchas Talmud Torah, he rewrote the whole thing from scratch, because the Rishayim and the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam, they didn't do such a fantastic job at Hilchas Talmud Torah. So one of the many things that the Baal HaTanya has in his Shulchan Aruch, Harab, on Hilchas Talmud Torah, is he raises the question, we all have an obligation to learn Kol HaTorah Kula. How is that humanly possible? The Gemara in Eretz comments on the Pasuk that says, Arucham Eretz Midor, Rechovim Minayam, that's a reference to the Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebaal Peh is so expansive. It's so much. You go to any library, there are thousands and thousands of svarim. So how is it possible to master all of Torah Shebaal Peh? How is it possible to master Kol HaTorah Kula? So the Baal HaTanya says, Kol HaTorah Kula can be put into one bookcase. Kol HaTorah Kula, the text of Kol HaTorah Kula consists of the 24 svarim in Tanakh. Believe it or not, learning the Vayim Ketuvim is also Talmud Torah. Some of the boys in the yeshiva talk it into themselves that the Tanakh is for the Maskilim. Unfortunately, Maskilim are misinterpreting Tanakh. Tanakh is for us. The whole Hashkafah of the Torah comes from the Tanakh. So we're supposed to learn, not only are we supposed to be Mavi Sedra every week, we're supposed to learn the Vayim Ketuvim as well. Unfortunately, we don't do such a good job on that. So Kol HaTorah Kula consists of Tanakh, of Mishnayos, Tosefta, Talmud Bavli, Rishalmi, Sifros and Frey Mechilte, Ramam and Shulchan Aruch. That's what the Baal HaTanya says. And to tell you the truth, it's not so much. And people who go to law school probably have to read more books than that. What the Gemara meant, the Gemara comments on that pasuk, Aruch HaMeir, it's Midor, Rechovim, Minayam, that the Torah is so vast, it's Aruch HaMeir, it's Midor, that's on the depth of understanding of the Torah Shebaal Peh. You can always go deeper, deeper, deeper. You can always understand better. That's on the omic, pnimius, pilpul shel Torah. But just what is the text of Kol HaTorah Kula? We all have an obligation to master it. That it is possible to master. And you have to go in an organized fashion. You have to go menakala lakovit. So even if you just started to learn at the age of 20, even if you just start to learn at the age of... Before the age of 20, you probably didn't have a head to understand Torah anyway. Now your mind is functioning normally. So now you should try to dedicate as much time as possible to the mastering Kol HaTorah Kula. And whatever you're going to do for a living, you shouldn't make a mistake and think that learning is only for those who plan to go into Chinuch HaRabbanus. Learning Torah is for every Jew. Every Jew is obligated to learn, wealthy or poor, whatever he does for a living, healthy or sick. Everyone is obligated to learn every day of his life till the day that he dies. That's how the Rambam writes from the Gemara. Everyone is obligated to learn. Kol HaTorah Kula. If you cut out to go into Chinuch HaRabbanus, so good, so try to do that. If you're not cut out, so don't. It'll be a tragedy if a person will go into a field that he doesn't belong. But our goal should be to master Kol HaTorah Kula. There are businessmen who learn Daf Yomi. Every 7.5 years, they learn again, they learn again, and they know it well. The first time you learn it, it goes in one ear and out the other. Second time you learn it, a little more sinks in, a little more stays. And the third time you learn it, you'll remember even more. Not so difficult, not so difficult. You have to go a little at a time. How late do the people have to break, no? By me, it's only 5:15. By you, it's 12:00 at night. These were the six that I picked out.
Can I ask Rebbe one or two others? I know the. I think they said maybe we can go a couple more minutes. Is that okay? One of the questions that one of the boys asked is what our view should be on the special needs children, special needs community. I remember I was once talking to Rav Aaron Kahn after he visited Camp Cayley, which is where I spend the summer, and they have a lot of special needs children there. And he said, the difference between my level of learning and these children's level of learning is not as great as the difference between the Vilna Gaon and my level of learning. And the Vilna Gaon doesn't laugh at me for trying to learn. So, but does Rebbe have any perspective on how we should view why people face these kinds of challenges or what their role is?
I used to be friendly with Rabbi Mala Galinsky. Passed away already a long time ago. He used to be my next door neighbor in the summertime for quite a few years. Mala Galinsky used to work in the Jewish Agency when they first started sending the boys and the girls to Eretz Yisrael for a year in between high school and college. And then he moved to Eretz Yisrael. He was always what you would call a Zionist. Then he moved to Eretz Yisrael. He was in Shivat Shalavim. He was in charge of the American program there. So, Mal Galinsky, for quite a while, lived in Beit Vegan. So he told me that he had a neighbor from the neighborhood, not his next-door neighbors, an acquaintance of his, who was a descendant of a great Hasidic Rebbe from 200 years ago, from the 1700s. And he has a manuscript from that Elta Zeta, and his acquaintance says he can't print the manuscript. The people will say that it's a forgery. Why? This Hasidic Rebbe wrote in the 1700s that when the Dor HaMidbar died, they went up to heaven, and the Rabbanu Shalom said it's going to punish them for rejecting Eretz Yisrael. They didn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael. So they asked the Rabbanu Shalom, have Rachmanis on us, let us come back as a Gilgal, and we'll be Mesakan HaRaveret. So Rabbanu Shalom said, no, he's not going to let him come back as a Gilgal. Back and forth, they're arguing, until finally Rabbanu Shalom says, okay, I'll make a compromise. I'll let you go back as a Gilgal to be Mesakan the Avera that you rejected Eretz Yisrael, but on the condition that you only do that one mitzvah. You only do the one mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. You're not allowed to do any more mitzvahs. So who would believe that Chassidus Rebbe had such a wild cholam in the 1700s? The people who built up Eretz Yisrael, they gave their lives to Eretz Yisrael. They were such anti-religious people. They didn't do any mitzvahs, only Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. How could a Chassidus Rebbe even have such an imagination? So they said, so this acquaintance of Mala Galinsky said, he can't print the manuscript because they'll say it's a forgery. It was written by somebody after the Hakamas HaMedina, looking back, and then he's going to say that that's what it is. Sometimes there is such a concept of Gilgal Neshamas. We don't know. Rabbi Chizai Kreskis was the Godel Ador, they say, in the name of in the generation of the Ran. We have a book on Hashkafa by him, Or Hashem, and on philosophy, Jewish philosophy. We have a little bit halacha from him, the Shita Mekubetz's quotes once in a while, Rabbi Chizai Kreskis. So in his book, Or Hashem, his book on philosophy, he talks about what we do believe in, what we don't believe in, and other things are not really part of our religion, like what's the distance of the earth from the sun? That's not part of our religion. So he writes, one of the things that's not the nikar in our religion, one way or the other is there such a thing as Gilgal Neshamas? Maybe yeah, maybe no. We don't have anything in our religion based on that. But if you do assume that there is such a thing as Gilgal Neshamas, then you can begin to understand why people are born into the world with handicaps. It's a Gilgal of a Neshama because of something that they did in an earlier generation, in an earlier Gilgal. So they're sent back into the world in order to accomplish something a second time around. And not that they have chiruch hafshis and a challenge to try to accomplish a whole life of Torah and Yerushalayim, just to be misaken one little aspect. That's what, if you believe in Gilgal Neshamas, then you can understand why sometimes babies die when they're little babies. What avera did they do? They were infants. There can't be a punishment for something that they did that was wrong. They didn't do anything yet. They're la bardas. So we don't know why the Rabbanu Shalom sends people as a Gilgal. But if you should assume that there is such a thing, so maybe there's some reason why these souls were brought into the world. We don't understand. The kids, we don't understand how the Ribbono Shel Olam runs his world. But there must be some reason in Hashem mind why there are special needs people in the community. It's a challenge for us, how we'll deal with them. To say it's a challenge for them. A lot of them are not to be held responsible for anything that they do.
Can we close with just two questions? Just one, two final questions. I remember several times when we were sitting with Rebbe in the OU and Rebbe was paskening all the shailas that were coming in, there was a difficult passage in the Igros Moshe, and Rebbe would say, this we have to ask Rav David, what Rav Moshe meant over here. Can Rebbe maybe tell us a little bit about what Rav David meant to the post Rav Moshe generation, and if there's anything the Talmidim maybe can learn from Rav David Zichrono Livracha?
Rav David Feinstein was there when his father was working out all of these Jews. I think his brother, Rav Reuven Feinstein, was learning in Cleveland. He was learning in Telsa Yeshiva. But Rav David was there when his father was working on these Jews. So a lot of the Jews of Rav Moshe, you're missing part of the information. The psaka is based on a condition that's sometimes not written in the tshuva, based on an assumption in halacha that's not written in the tshuva. So a lot of times people will misread things in the Igros Moshe. So the one who knew, sometimes there are contradictions between different tshuvas. Rav David Feinstein explained, no, this tshuva, Chochma Askina, he was there. He said, this tshuva, there's one piece of information missing. That's why the din is like that over there. And over here it's not. So a lot of times things are misunderstood. Things are sorely misunderstood in many of the Igros Moshe. So he was, sometimes he was the only one who would know the correct shot in the tshuva. So we had to ask him a lot of times, yeah.
So he was an example of someone who connected himself to a Gadol B'Torah and made sure that he was around to pick up all of the nuances.
He was like his father in that sense. Rav Moshe was an exaggeration of humility. There happened to be, Rav Moshe Feinstein a lot of times writes a tshuva and he says, this is in disagreement with the Nadi Behuda, this is in disagreement with the Chassam Sefer. So years ago, many years ago, there was a certain Hungarian rabbi who lived in the New York area, who was a big Talmud Chacham, who wrote a whole Sefer attacking Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe's Sefer is Igros Moshe. This Sefer is called Mane LeIgoris, the response to the Igros Moshe. So he attacks Rav Moshe. He says, Rav Moshe is so arrogant, he thinks he's greater than the Chassam Sefer and greater than the Nadi Behuda and greater than the Shach, that he has the right to disagree with all of these people. So Rav Moshe felt so hurt when they printed the Sefer. He said, I don't think I'm greater. I don't even know if I'm entitled to an opinion at all. But Rabbanim keep on pressuring me. They want to know my opinion. So if they're pressuring me, they want to know my opinion. I have an obligation to tell them my honest to goodness opinion. It's not a lot of fudge. They have to say, I don't agree with the Nadi Behuda, I don't agree with the Chassam Sefer. That's Allah. If you're entitled to an opinion, he said, I don't know if I'm entitled to an opinion. Moshe was unbelievably humble, unbelievably humble. I didn't learn Barab Moshe, but the little interaction that we had with him, he was extremely humble, extremely humble. And Rabbi David Feinstein also, extremely private. For so many years, he never spoke in public. He wouldn't want to speak in public. Until they finally pressured him. The last couple of years of his life, they pressured him. He has to speak in public. He was extremely humble, like he picked it up from his father. And he knew all the father's stuff. He understood which kulas his father. But a lot of times, Moshe wrote a kula, but he didn't like it. He read the tshuvas, he can't tell which are the kulas that he's recommending, which are the kulas if you want to, but he's not really recommending. He was there. He knew which kulas were recommended to Bnei Torah and which only for Balabatim. Yeah.
And finally, can
I want to know if you have any recollection about Rabbi Jonathan Sachs? Just one, I had an interaction with him a few times that I visited England. So I met with at the conferences of the rabbis there. So he is a very interesting person. So a few years ago, there used to be Mr. Marcus Katz from Mexico City. So he used to give a Pras Katz every year to someone who published a Sefer which furthered the cause of orthodoxy in the modern world. And then for 3 years, they didn't give any proskasts. And then the fourth year, they gave to four people. So I was one of the people. They gave me a check, a matana check. And one was Rabbi Jonathan Sacks for all the books that he put out. And one was Rav Neuwirth, who wrote the Shmir Shabbos Kol Chos, had already passed away. So it was almost, the son was still saying Kaddish. It was the end of the 11th month. So he passed away, so his wife was there and his children were there. And the fourth one was Rav Zalman Nechemi Goldberg. So these were the four people. So of the four, one had passed away already. Rav Neuwirth passed away. And the three of us were sitting there next to each other. So I leaned over to my left, Rav Zalman Nechemia, we're sitting together, and I told him in Hebrew, and maybe Yiddish, I feel so uncomfortable sharing an honor with you. This man, Rav Zalman Nechemia, he was the son of Lord Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He's the one who set up all the positions in the Bat Dinim and Eretz Yisrael and Gitme Kiddush and everything. And he would go visit a yeshiva. He used to visit Hesdi yeshivas, Mizrahi yeshivas. And I would ask him to say a shiur. He said, what are you learning? On the spot, he'd give a shiur. He didn't even know in advance what mesichta they're learning. He'd just come and he would say a shiur. So I leaned over to him and I said, I feel so uncomfortable. They gave me an honor together with you. How do I compare to you? So the chief Rabbi Sacks was sitting to my right. So he leans over to me. He says, he feels so uncomfortable sharing an honor with me. How does he compare to me? How does he compare? Wow, he was fantastic. He was a fantastic speaker, fantastic writer. He was something else. I remember on one occasion when I was there by a rabbinical conference, it was a 3-day conference. So they had one session in the evening where they wanted I was one of the speakers and Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. And the third one was Rabbi Gelli's son. I forgot his first name. Rabbi Gelli's son is a dayan for the United Synagogues in London. So they wanted us to talk about who our Rebbe was and our relationship with our Rebbe. So I was talking about Rav Soloveitchik, and the Rabbi Gelli had learned in Ponovitch. He was talking about his relationship with Rav Shach. And then Rabbi Jonathan Sacks was talking about what's his name?
Rabinovich.
Rabbi Rabinovich, right. From Male Adumim, because he learned by him at Jews College. It was very, very fascinating. Very fascinating. He's a very interesting person. Yeah.
Can Rabbi maybe close with some Divrei Bracha for all the Talmidim that are learning in Eretz Yisrael? They've been learning with Mesiras Nefesh, never even leaving Yeshiva for many of them because of the pandemic. So maybe Rabbi can give some Divrei Bracha.
It's a good thing. If you don't leave the yeshiva, you don't get involved in politics and the movies and the narishkeit that's going on in the street. There's nothing going on in the street now. You should sit in yeshivas and learn. Make sure your mother said every week. Make sure you learn a little bit in the Maksuvim. Make a zman every day, 15, 20 minutes, to learn a perik and Yeshua, Shoptim, Shmomel. Learn Tanakh together and try to master whatever mesichta you're learning, whatever yeshiva. Try to cover the whole mesichta. Not just to learn 5 blot a year, 10 blot a year. Try to cover the whole Masichta from the beginning to the end. You have to chazer a lot. They used to say there's a medrash, I don't know, I think they made it up, that one who learns and doesn't chazer is like one who plants and doesn't harvest what grows. You have to chazer. The main thing is you have to chazer. The Gdolim in Europe used to chazer before Rosh Hashanah. They would chazer Maseches Rosh Hashanah. Before Yom Kippur, they would chazer Yom. Before Sukkah, they would chazer Sukkah. Every Shabbos, they would chazer parts of Shabbos. So if you keep on chazering, so you'll be on your toes. The more you learn and the more you chazer, so the more you'll be a Talmid Chacham. Everything in Halacha is interconnected. Whatever you learn this year will help you understand next year better. Then the third year, whatever you learned the first 2 years, everything is interconnected. After you learn enough, everything falls into place by itself. Right now, you learn a din, it seems strange, but the more you learn, the more background you know, so the more you realize that all the details fit into it. It's a one big picture, one big mosaic, and everything fits into the pattern. You'll enjoy learning. When you understand how everything fits in, you'll enjoy learning. You should all have atzlocha in learning and enjoy the learning. Very good.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Okay.